Thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell. I'm joined today by Emery Roan and Matt Curtis. And we're going to talk about embedding technology. A judge in New York thinks it could be infringing. Science has a pirate queen. YouTube is moderating its controversial YouTubers. And will AI help you understand your terms of service? All this and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Matt Curtis, and Mike Keyes. Episode 414, recorded February 16th, 2018. Viral ads with legs. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. Save $50 on your order at trygrasshopper.com/twit. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. So excited to be here. The courts of our fine nation have been up to a lot lately. We're going to talk about some of those interesting developments. And I'm so thrilled that two of my favorite people are here to share the show with me today. Matt Curtis is here. He is a law student at Notre Dame. Hi, Matt. Great to see you.
Hi. Great to see you, too. And great to have Emery on again. So this will be a fun show.
Yes. And Emery Roan is officially our guest this week, no longer co-hosting the show on a regular basis with us, but good enough to his word, still coming back whenever we can rope him back, and we roped him back this week as our guest. Hi, Emery. Great to see you.
Hey, Denise. Hey, Matt. It's great to be back. It's, you know, it's been tough. I have missed the TWiT weekly ritual, I'll say, quite a
yes.
bit. So I'm happy to be back and glad to be talking about some interesting stuff at technology and law.
Yes. Bring us up to speed on what's up with you these days. You are a card-carrying member of the California Bar.
I am, though I have to say I don't have the card yet. I don't think they're automatically mailing them out. I have to submit it. But I paid my fees, so and they can't take that away. So I am barred. I'm a member of the California Bar. I'm working at the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse here in Hillcrest, San Diego. It's a really excellent privacy nonprofit. Currently on some contract basis, but maybe that'll improve to a full-time position later on. And I am, thank you, Victor, for just adding S to the bottom third. That's official. And I'm also co-hosting another podcast for the Internet Law and Policy Foundry called Tech Policy Grind. And that's been a lot of fun and taking up a lot of time as well.
Yes, so. I want to talk about that more detail later on in the show. That's so funny that you mentioned that they no longer send you bar cards. That's been a couple years now that they've decided, I don't know, this is a way the state bar is economizing probably, or just deciding, you know, who really needs a bar card, and if you really need one, then let us know and we'll send you one. I don't even know if they send out something that properly looks like anything other than a piece of paper that you didn't print from your printer. But that's another thing you can do is you can log onto your account and actually print something out and then cut around it and put it in your wallet if you need to or want to or think that that will do anybody any good. But
Emery, and we can send you some really nice like ridged scissors to do the cutting on that just to make it feel more official. Yeah.
Well, I've got some that, you know, cut out the hearts as you cut, so maybe that won't be totally appropriate, but we'll see.
I feel like the California Bar is ahead of its time. You know, we have cryptocurrency that nobody sees. Now we have crypto bar cards.
All right.
They exist. You just don't get to see them.
my record's on the bar blockchain, then we can start grabbing the pitchforks.
Yes. Well, yeah. We're putting it all on the blockchain, Matt. Putting everybody's bar registration on the blockchain. An indisputable proof that you have passed the bar.
I'm not taking it.
They don't have proof of that because honestly, if someone's passed the bar, they're not going to let you forget it.
That's right. The only time I've ever needed a bar card, and I know I've mentioned this on the show before, but I get no end of pleasure in mentioning that the only time it's ever in my entire history as a lawyer come in handy for me is when friends have wound up in custody and you need to go down and try and help them with that, you know, let them have bail posted or whatever. Then police departments like to see that you have a bar card. So handy thing to have in those.
I work too darn hard to have something in my wallet that I can say, look at this.
Yeah.
So I'll get it eventually,
very
whether I have to print it out DIY it myself or not.
All right, so as I teased, courts have been busy. Let's talk about one such case. We've got a bunch to talk about in the copyright realm. All right, this was a trial court judge in New York. A federal trial judge has issued, her name is Kathleen Forrest, I believe. And she has issued a surprise decision that actually, if you go back and you read things that I was writing for ZDNet a long time ago, I remember I couldn't pull up the exact blog post because I didn't spend any time really trying to find it. But I remember writing back in like 2007, 2008, thereabouts, that some judge was going to do this. And lo and behold, here in 2018, it happened. And essentially what this judge has done is decide to turn a very judicially blind eye to the pesky details of how technology works and who's really doing what, and really just look at sort of what she could see was happening and what users see happen when somebody embeds something. I'm presuming that most of our listeners and viewers are familiar not just with the process of embedding. You've probably embedded things yourselves, but the underlying nuts and bolts of how that works and whose servers are involved. But turns out federal judges and probably tons of lay people who just surf the web aren't really aware that of the difference between when you display an image on your website, you are hosting that image and you are pointing to it somewhere that you are responsible for maintaining, and when you're using some code that allows you to embed the image and it's hosted somewhere else. This judge decided it doesn't really matter for her purposes, that the end result is you are seeing an image on the site. In this case, the allegation is that the image is infringing, and that should be enough to defeat summary judgment. She denied a motion for summary judgment in this case. So let me tell you what happened more specifically. There was a photo of Tom Brady that an individual took. And he uploaded it to Snapchat. And this is, I guess, a great object lesson, too, that if you're using Snapchat, don't think that the things that you're posting there are just going to go away and not be used. Justin Goldman was the name of the photographer. He took a picture of Tom Brady, Boston Celtics manager Danny, oh gosh, Ainge, is that his name? They were on a street together. He uploaded that shot to Snapchat. Although Snapchat things are supposed to go away, this one did not. Others uploaded it to various places, including Twitter. So it's living then on Twitter's servers, right? And then certain news outlets began using the image by embedding the tweet with the image there. So they would just embed that in their stories. And Justin Goldman, the photographer, came after the news outlets, which included Breitbart, Time, Yahoo, Vox Media, Gannett, a whole bunch of them, who are now contesting the case, defending the case, and brought summary judgment saying, hey, we didn't infringe anything. You know, we were just pointing to an infringing image by embedding it. How can that be infringement? Well, the judge decided that it was because she really didn't care about who was doing what behind the scenes. What mattered most to this judge was that you, in viewing the news story, could see the image. So in that sense, that was enough to defeat summary judgment. The case is going to go on. They may have other arguments to make at trial, but she decided to let this continue. In issuing her opinion denying summary judgment, in addition to just not really caring or thinking that there should be legal significance to what is technologically going on here, I'm a little concerned with this judge's conclusions. At one point she said she's trying to sort of console all the news organization defendants because she's not granting their motion, and assuring them that they have what she thinks are strong defenses that they can still assert and potentially win the case. And one of the defenses that she says is she thinks there's a genuine question about whether the plaintiff, the photographer, effectively released this image into the public domain when he posted it to his Snapchat account. Hello? that's not how copyright law works. That's completely antithetical to how copyright law works. Although, and then she goes on to write, in many cases, there are likely to be factual questions as to licensing and authorization. So she seems to be sort of dancing around the idea that maybe by posting something to some social media or sharing forum, you are doing an implied license. Maybe that's where she's going. I don't know. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how this case plays out. Again, it's only at the trial court level. So if we do have a judge who's just got a fundamental misunderstanding of the law, she has also, in her opinion, rejected what's called the server test, which is something the Ninth Circuit and other areas have adopted, which does pay attention to how the technology of all this works. And she said, no, we're not in the Ninth Circuit, so I don't have to follow that. If we do have a judge that just fundamentally doesn't understand the law, then there is an appellate process that can deal with that. Opening it up to you guys. Emery, what do you think of all this?
Yeah, I mean, you hit on basically everything I was going to say. I mean, I think that it is a decision that flies in the face of practical reality. And I believe also I agree with you that it is a misunderstanding. It reflects a misunderstanding of the technology and of the law. I mean, this is the server test that you sort of touched on, I think, is maybe something worth exploring a little bit. But we're talking about the Perfect 10 case, Perfect 10 v. Amazon and Google. In that case, Perfect 10 had claimed that Google, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's been a few years since I've read this, Matt, and I should think that you probably have more immediate knowledge of this. But Perfect 10, if I remember correctly, was that had to deal with Google image links and the idea that Perfect 10 was saying that Google was infringing on their copyright by having these links to images on the Google Images search results page. And the court eventually decided that, one, Google's use was transformational, and that the links were fundamentally not displaying the work but acting as signposts to guide people to the original work. And then they also created the server test, and the server test looks to whether the infringing material is hosted on a server, is whether the publisher of the infringing material is the server where the infringing material is stored physically, or if it's just the person that is linking to that server. And so the server test is basically the norm that the entire internet has been operating under since Perfect 10. And frankly, I mean, if I was to ever play devil's advocate and agree at all with the judge here, I would say that I've always found the server test to be a little arbitrary. The focus on where the actual bytes of the image are stored on a hard disk versus where the image is actually displayed, I feel like is not the correct or not the best maybe distinction or the line to draw. Because I do agree, frankly, that, you know, if we're looking at the letter of the law or we're looking at the letter of copyright, of the Copyright Act, it is displaying an image. I also agree with you, Denise, that the idea that he's releasing the images into the public domain is really weird. And it's a very odd choice of wording. I think, again, you hit on it that maybe the more interesting argument to explore there is that there's an implied license, which I could actually find fairly convincing, that when you're posting your work on a platform that is explicitly designed to be distributed or redistributed, when you're posting on a platform where there's a little share icon right underneath your photograph that by clicking it provides the embed code that not only displays your image but links to you, thus giving attribution. It feels a lot like you might be, you could be considered to be granting an implied license to reshare your work. I didn't follow this case as it was developing, or at least the underlying facts of the case. I'm not going to say sports ball because I have learned this year that that is an offensive, poor term to use. But I didn't follow the story of this photograph from Snapchat to Reddit to Twitter. But clearly, the original photographer lost control of this work fairly early in the process. Which I think reflects maybe a different problem altogether than simply news organizations linking to original images. And again, at the end of the day, I think that it's pretty clear that this would be a fair use of the image, even considering in argumento everything else that we've said. This is a newsworthy event. They're talking about it critically. The photograph is specifically being used to talk about this developing issue, I believe. So, yeah, it seems like a really bad decision, and I wonder what's going to happen next. It will be interesting to follow.
Yeah, I don't know how we've escaped seeing headlines that say Snapchat users use Snapchat, donate works to public domain, says federal judge.
That's so true. Yes, absolutely.
Matt, any other thoughts?
Yeah, so just a little bit to clarify the Amazon Perfect versus Perfect 10. They were only talking about the smaller image on Google, and there was actually a separate analysis so when you go on Google and you're on the images page, there's the first click where you see the rows of images. Those were the images that they were talking about for the embedding. So the analysis was actually on the smaller images, and it seemed to indicate that if it was talking about the larger images that pop up later, that those would be would have a different analysis for embedding. So the original case does have some sizing, proportionality, and also the fact that Google is a search engine. We were dealing with how do we, not third parties copying content, but Google or a search engine bringing together all of the search engines, all of these images. So it was a little bit different. And the other thing with the different was that we weren't talking about the Perfect 10 images weren't being copied. Yeah, so these images are what the original analysis was on. And if you click there further, that second image was not part of that analysis. That was actually hosted separately from the website. Secondly, we were talking about is images that were not drawn from the Perfect 10 website. They were drawn from another website that had copied Perfect 10s. So that's where the question of copyright was in that case. Now, that being all said, that case has come to mean that you can embed anything. So from first principles, I'm not sure that her analysis is that bad. I just don't think that's how the law has come to interpret that original case. And the second thing about the copyright display, as in you have this implied license, that just doesn't make any sense. That's just, as Denise said and Emery said, that's just not how the law works, and that's just crazy. So I did like the point that they actually pushed it back to the trial court, which was just a standard of proof that the court, I believe I have this right, that the jury instructions were
– Oh, no. Different case.
Oh, sorry. I thought the same case.
Yeah.
Thanks, Denise.
No, this is – yeah.
I'll stop.
We're getting there, but not yet.
All right.
We haven't even passed summary judgment yet in this case.
All right. Whoops.
She was denying a summary judgment motion here. So appellate courts may well get involved, but they're not yet. The interesting thing too is, and again, she sort of alludes to it in her order denying summary judgment. She mentions that the DMCA could be a defense for the news organizations. And I think what she may be getting at there is maybe The recourse for this photographer is to go to Twitter and use the DMCA and say you have infringing material on your site and take it down. That's how that works.
I really hope that one of my classmates is not her law clerk.
Yeah. me too. So we'll continue keeping an eye on this case. It's an interesting one. It's got sweeping ramifications, right? Yeah. Because everybody embeds. And a lot of embedding works like this works. You're not, you're right to point out the distinction, Matt, between displaying a thumbnail and displaying the full image, or, you know, a good sized version of the image. A lot of embedding works. You're seeing a complete video. You're seeing the image as you would see it on the original site. So if this court
and with devices,
continues down this road, it may alter a lot of what people do online. Go ahead.
I was just thinking that the relevance of the size of the image is something that I feel like is growing more and more arbitrary as, you know, I mean, obviously no one needs to be preaching to the choir about mobile usage versus desktop usage, but, you know, the size of a thumbnail versus on a phone versus the size of a thumbnail, it's still displaying the image. You know, I think that even the underlying technology of how that image is being displayed, you know, are they actually linking to a smaller pixel-wide pixel version of the image, or is it just that the larger pixel image is being displayed smaller on the screen due to website CSS or whatever? I don't know. It feels like there is something weird there, something that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But yeah, we can move on.
I don't think that the original ruling was like that good of a ruling. I think it was that they needed to come up for a reason why Google could exist and it couldn't be stopped by a pornography website. So I think that's how they justified it. I'm not sure if that's like a actual good rationality.
Can we all appreciate as like tech law folks how much of a bullet was dodged with the name of Perfect 10's website? Like that could have been a really embarrassing, you know, the past, I don't know how many years since Perfect 10, if Perfect 10 was named like most porn website names out there.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been awkward. Sorry, Matt, continue.
It tamely could have been called Perfect Jugs or anything else. Yeah. Nope. You're absolutely right. That one. We have dodged the bullet.
But I think that like, you know, if you're talking about embedding of like, so you could theoretically embed like an entire website. So if I embedded all of Twit and posted all of their, you know, just pulled all of their information from their servers, that would be copyright infringement. So I do think that there's like a proportionality justification, but I don't see a clear line. So if the only thing on my website is a video and you take that and embed it, one, I should just put protocols that you can't embed it on it. That's my fault. But in terms of the copyright liability for that, that shouldn't have anything to do with the sort of security protocols I put on there. So I think it's really a much harder question than it appears to be. The way we've gone is just like let people embed, and you know you can put security protocols on it to make it more secure, but the default is that there's not liability.
Yeah.
Oh, I
wonder
think,
if just the straight fair use argument was the strongest part of Perfect 10.
Yeah.
The implications for linking are not fair. Sorry, right. Denise.
No, I see. We're back to Perfect 10, and they're you know, you weren't in the realm of social media where embed codes are freely made available. Please use them. You know, I think you're in a very different realm when that's the case. But then you're to the responsibility of the person supplying that embed code to make it easy to share the work around, that the work, you know, if it's infringing, should they have it up? And they shouldn't have it up if they've received a DMCA takedown notice, which apparently Twitter never did about this. So interesting. Go ahead.
The copyright is owned by the individual, and then Twitter is providing the embed code. So it's right. Not even as clear. Like maybe this person doesn't know anything about embedding codes or anything like that. It's a third party that's providing that.
Exactly. And it's not like if it would be, I think, a slightly different issue if he had posted the photograph on his Twitter account. Also, I remember he posted on Snapchat. Yeah. It was then picked up by Virally, and some third party eventually put it on their Twitter. And so clearly, like, even if there was an implied license, even if such an implied license could be created by sharing your content on a social network, I'm not saying that it does. But even if that was the case, it's clear that it wouldn't be in this case because he didn't post it on Twitter. So right. He lost control of his image much, much earlier in the process.
And if he had posted it, if he had posted it on Twitter, or if it were a video that he'd posted to YouTube, then the licensing is built into the terms of service. When you are right. When you are sharing on formats like that, you're at least granting a license to the other users on the platform for them to be able to share right. it around. And oftentimes you're granting a broader license than that, specifically in the terms of service. Interestingly, I mean, as long as we're talking about if you upload something, are you putting it in the public domain? I don't know if anybody uses Flickr anymore, but that's an option on Flickr. It's an option you have to select. But yeah, Flickr was one of the first sites to incorporate Creative Commons.
How do they do that? Is it a license zero, or do they? As I understand it, it's difficult to actually revoke any copyright interest that you hold and to put something in the public domain, and that's what the license zero was trying to do. But
right.
I understand that Creative Commons has sort of backed off of license zero. Do you know what the case is on that right now?
I know that Flickr struggled with that, and I'm not quite sure if they decided to go license zero or they did it another way. But there is mm-hmm. a public domain option when you upload there. So
awesome!
It's sort of a counterpoint to other sites like Snapchat who don't offer that option at all. The default is going to be that you're keeping your copyright. You're not licensing at all, unless some judge decides to come in and state that there's an implied license, and then that gets kicked up and becomes law. Who knows? But that's not per the Copyright Act. All right. Speaking of interesting copyright decisions and ones that ultimately did involve jury instructions and then wound up at trial and resulting in a decision, and now have gone before the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. This was the case, I know we've talked about it on the show before, involving BMG and Cox. And it was sort of a big deal when it happened because what wound up happening is Cox was slapped pretty hard by BMG, who was upset. BMG manages rights for all kinds of artists, including David Bowie and Bruno Mars and others, and was not happy with the fact that Cox seemed to have a lot of infringement going on by its ISP users. And so despite the fact that it had flagged piracy violations and sent Cox lots and lots of notices that had been generated for BMG by Rights Corp, it wasn't happy with how Cox was dealing with that. And this comes down to the DMCA again and what protects entities like ISPs from liability of their users. And they do have to take steps if they have found that people are abusing the law and their own policies and continuing to engage in activity that could be infringement, even though there's not been any legal adjudication that anything infringed, they may find themselves in hot water. And that's what happened here with Cox. A $25 million jury verdict was entered against it. Because it was found that although Cox had sort of a 13 strikes program that it was implementing, it would send out notices and advise people that this conduct was not acceptable on the service. What came out at trial was that it wasn't actually terminating accounts. And the jury concluded that Cox was merely paying lip service to its policies. It wasn't really it didn't want to terminate users, and so it wasn't, even though it had policies that said that it would after certain things had happened. So that's what happened at trial. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeal, when it looked at this, wiped out that $25 million verdict and is going to send it back and have a new trial. And Matt, why don't you tell us about the jury instruction that was problematic here?
So it was just the issue was, I'm trying to get to it real quick, but it was just a standard of proof issue. And so what the DMCA requires is that if they, I believe it's if they have, I'm not covering this very well, but if they have knowledge of actual knowledge, so not just that there's a high probability that there's copyright infringements being taken, or even that of, you know, the original case was a YouTube case, which said that even if we know that there's 60 million copyright infringement on here, unless you know of a specific one, or you are willfully blind to that, then that is the standard of care. And I believe the jury instruction said something like, if they should have known whether was. And so the standard is that if they should have known, then their liability would be different. And so they just have to go back and retry it under the willful blindness standard, I believe.
Matt, can you break down just for us, totally for our listeners, by the way, it's absolutely not my question, but just for our uninformed listeners, could you please give maybe a distinction between willful blindness and should have known?
Okay, so if it should have known, so if we're looking at like, so say you're a traffic cop and you're watching, you're watching on a data algorithm of seeing 100 cars pass, and you see that you, on average, you can determine that based on their total times that the 25 of them had to be speeding, right? So if you know that 25 of them had to be speeding, then you should have known, right? So that would be the standard of that. But if you are like at the stoplight and you're watching there, and then you're looking away when you hear like a certain noise that indicates that someone's speeding, that means you're willfully blind. It's almost like you're turning away from the action in place. So getting a DMCA notice is like hearing the car rumbling that you know is going faster. And so because, you know, it seems like they had 13 instances of DMCA notices about specific users. And so that's a lot. I don't remember what the average is, but it's somewhere around 7 to 8 that most companies put in place. And then it seems like they weren't even following their protocols if there were 13. So they knew that users were infringing in some way and then just continued to have like almost a fake policy that said that they were watching but really weren't.
Honestly, I don't know if that was helpful. Like thing that you're trying to avoid is being said that you're willfully blind, the naming your program 13 strikes seems like a really poor decision given that strikes generally are held to be 3. Why wouldn't you just say
– I don't think they named it that.
Markers or attributes, you know, or like anything other. Like, you know, I don't know. it's hard to say that they're not willfully blind if they're instituting a program called 13 strikes.
Yeah, no, that's not what it was called. That's what the judge called it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Probably the opposing counsel did a really good job of drilling that into the judge's mind.
Yeah.
Mm. Evidently.
Yes. The other interesting thing about the case is, aside from setting aside the verdict and making the parties go back and retry it, the appellate court did buy in to the trial court's conclusion that the DMCA requires you to meaningfully implement your policy that terminates the service of repeat infringers. You can't just sort of have this policy and then never follow through on it. So there was some argument back and forth, both at the trial and at appeal, about what it means under the statute to be a repeat infringer. As I mentioned before, none of these people have been tried for copyright infringement. So this is all having to do with documentation and proof provided by Rights Corp via BMG, submitted to the ISP. that says, hey, you know, we've identified this user and they've got such and such files, you know,
which can also be done algorithmically and in mass, which is apparently what did happen. Cox was saying that the reason why they are not actually implementing these is that they're inundated by these complaints, and that the complaints frequently lack vital information. And I could certainly see that.
I do think that there's a problem in the whole system there, and that Cox had something to talk about. They specifically pointed out too that the DMCA in some places talks about repeat infringers and some places talks about alleged infringers, presumably acknowledging that, you know, nobody's gone to trial here. There's been no legal adjudication of this. So we're leaving it to you under this safe harbor structure that we have instituted to figure all this out. And
I think it was a compelling argument. I did find the argument interesting, maybe I've got to be very careful with my words. I did, but maybe compelling that the purpose of the DMCA is actually alleged offenders, because how much of an actual meaningful punishment is it to take away someone's internet access once they're already liable for civil damages? I thought that was interesting. I hadn't considered that before.
Yeah. All right. So BMG. So go ahead.
No, it just seems like the purpose of the DMCA is to have the private companies push law. You know, right. You know, access to the internet and giving. You know, if you think of that as a right to have access to internet, then they're pushing that into a private form of action, and basically the law pushes upon the corporation to implement what they want individuals to do. And that's simply because it's too expensive to go after every individual. Mm-hmm. There's interesting Supreme Court cases that have come out recently who have stated, there was a North Carolina one, which held that being on Facebook was a fundamental right. Somehow I don't really understand that, but
yeah.
if we're thinking about, you know, if it's a fundamental right to be on Facebook and being on that sort of things, it is interesting to see whether, you know, just access to the internet is a fundamental right of some sort. That's kind of tangential, but it's just a private right, and so they're just trying to push the corporations to basically move the rule of law.
Right. Well, I think this has all given me our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, which is going to be 13 strikes, you better be out. Thank you, Cox. we put these phrases into the show in case you are a lawyer or another professional. Maybe you are a professor who likes to watch or listen to the show for continuing legal education or other professional credit. Oftentimes your oversight board will like to see that you actually watched or listened to the show and have to have some sort of palpable proof of that. So we put these phrases in the show. This is our first one, 13 strikes, you better be out. And we'll put another one in later on in the show at some point. So we talked about a case considering where liability should and should not apply if you're not hosting an image. You're simply pointing to an image hosted by somebody else. Now we've considered a case where your users are doing possibly infringing things, but have not been adjudicated to be infringers, and you have to police them. Moving on to an interesting article written up at The Verge about the state of academic articles, scientific journals, etc., and having access to them. The name of the article is Science's Pirate Queen, and it's really long. I do recommend
it's
it if you want to look it up. Yeah, it's a good read. But it's basically the saga of this woman in Russia who has become the repository of something called Sci-Hub that she's running that makes scientific papers that are otherwise behind a paywall available for free. And Elsevier, is that how we say that publisher? And various others, including ACS, have tried to go after her legally for many years. One got a pretty sweeping injunction against her, demanding that any internet service, any internet search engines, web hosting, and internet service providers, domain name registrars, and domain name registries stop doing anything to make Sci-Hub's operation and piracy possible. Again, we're looking at something here that, in the name of battling copyright infringement, may at minimum be overbroad, and more than that, may really change how the web works and what it means. Emery, you read this piece, it sounded like. What did you think of all this?
Yeah, first of all, I just can't recommend this piece enough. It is just a really, really great read. Honestly, fascinating, I think, no matter which angle you're coming from. And I read the article. I haven't been saying it. I didn't read it out loud, so I'm going to butcher her name. But Alexandra Elbakian, it just seems like a really incredible story to tell. The legal side, I guess, if we want to just stick to that discussion, is that, yeah, it is alarming when that a company can get an injunction on search engines or on the entire, you know, anyone that indexes the web and require them to essentially block out this website from their results. I mean, if we want the debate on open access to science, though, I think is something where, unfortunately, I think our philosophy and moral rights have the correct answer, and copyright does not. Clearly she's a pirate. Clearly she's infringing a lot of copyrighted work. She's not an American. I think also, just as a tangent aside, the political element of this issue is really fascinating. She considers herself a scientist communist, and the article talks about the way that communism and science as a theory or as a doctrine or school of thought have a lot of similarities or overlap. And that was something I never thought of. I don't have much of the legal analysis, unfortunately. Just it's really interesting. Read the article.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with the injunction here, and EFF is involved and definitely trying to either make sure this result is an isolated one or that it gets set aside. It's back to the SOPA and PIPA debate of, you know, can you block out websites that may be infringing? And that seems to be what's going on here, except instead of seeing legislation bringing that about, we're seeing a court order in the way of an injunction. So either way, by failing to point, you know, making you black out sites and making you be aware of whether they're infringing or not, that seems to be an obligation that could bring the entire internet to its knees if it were taken seriously. Matt, what do you think of all this?
Yeah, I mean, so like from a first instance, like clearly this is like stealing like massive amounts of academic research, and you understand the feeling that like this research should be free and open, you know, because it creates it, but you do have to look at the other side of it that the people who are doing this massive scientific research, they do need to get paid for their work. And so the underlying assumption that they're making is that these universities and governments are funding all this research. And that's partially true. So I think that's that's something we really haven't dealt with so well, is that there are massive public fundings for the production of science. You know, that's copyrights, that's patents, that's all this sort of thing. We don't really have a clear distinction of which of those should be in the public domain, because they've been paid for, and which of those should be privately held. I did think it was really interesting that, they were talking about the universities paying so much for their rights to access this. But on the flip side, these universities are getting massive checks from the publishers. And it's really the university's responsibilities to push these publishers to be more efficient and to drop their cost, because they're negotiating up on their publishing rights, and then they're having to pay more. And they're really the linchpin and the ones who have the power to do this, because they're funding the research, they're facilitating the public donations going into it. Other than that, I thought that the research was really good. And it's a tough position because the research is probably more expensive than it should be to get access to, but it probably shouldn't also be free. So I think it's a hard question.
Yeah, yep. It's a hard question, and it's definitely it's not just, you know, about what you can or cannot enjoin, but the whole just international nature of it, and the fact that because this woman, and I'm not going to try and pronounce her name either, Emery, in Russia, is determined to do this, and yet it's very hard to reach her legally, and even when you can, by way of this injunction, she just went to Twitter and told people to point their browsers to certain other domains where everything was still available and all was, you know, well again. It's just, it's a huge game of cat and mouse, and you know, it's not going to go away anytime soon. So I think it just sort of stands as this case study of IP enforcement on a global scale, and the fact that that's a very difficult thing to do, and what it means, you know, what the ramifications of that are. Are we going to legally take steps that we will regret? And yet, how are we going to, as Matt points out, make sure that the people who need to be compensated are compensated? So it's a tough question and a really good read. I'm glad they went deep on this one and wanted to bring that to your attention. Also wanted to bring to your attention that a case that we've mentioned a couple of times, again, copyright coming in to try and impose liability on people that may not deserve liability for what they've done. The Boing Boing case, where they pointed to, they didn't even display it here. There was no embedding, there was no display, but there was a link to an Imgur image that Playboy had the copyright in. And again, the recourse is to go and DMCA the sites that are hosting it, not come after blogs like Boing Boing, who may, for whatever reason, have linked to it. So there was a motion to dismiss, something that happens very early on in a case. And the motion to dismiss was granted, and it was granted with leave to amend. And this is a pretty commonplace thing. What's not commonplace is what that means is the plaintiff who's had their case dismissed has to go back to the drawing board and try and recraft their complaint in a way that cures the errors that the judge has found. What's not so common is the judge, and this is what the judge did here, coming in and granting the motion to dismiss and saying, you can go ahead and try and amend your complaint, but bear in mind, the exact language is carefully evaluate the contentions set forth in the defendant's motion to dismiss. So the court goes on to say it's skeptical that the plaintiff, it's apparently more than skeptical that the plaintiff had sufficiently alleged facts to support its claims, because it went ahead and dismissed the complaint. But it seems to be skeptical that the plaintiff can do that. So balls back in Playboy's court here to see if they're going to try and amend and argue that linking can be the basis for a lawsuit. So far, the complaint has been dismissed, and we'll have to see if they refile. Emery, any thoughts?
No, I mean, it tracks with our discussion earlier. I think that you hit on basically everything. Sorry, and I'm trying to excise ums from my vocabulary, and it's really hard, listeners. I'm sorry.
It's really hard.
This seems like exactly how the case that we discussed earlier should have been decided. Mm-hmm. But we will see what happens.
We will. Matt, any thoughts about Boing Boing?
Yeah, I just think this case is much clearer. Like, linking mm-hmm. is not problematic. I'm going to put all the ums in that Emery's taken out. Yeah, I just think that it's so clear that, you know, is there even a copyright on the link text that you're putting in there? Like, yeah, that's just crazy. Embedding is, you know, creates much more problematic because it can be like the whole website or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And linking is clearly so. I think that they did a good job. I love that the judge put some spice into it and said maybe not. And I just love the way that Techter writes their article. So,
oh my gosh,
they're just a lot of fun. Check it out.
So this is Mike Masnick. If you, I'm going to make a mid-show plug for my other show, Tech Policy Grind. Last week, all week, I posted interviews that we had at State of the Net, an internet policy conference in DC at the end of February. And I got to talk with Mike about fake news and maybe the dangers of trying to do too much about fake news too quickly. It was great. It was incredible. A real nerd moment for me because, yeah, Mike's work is incredible.
Yes, his work, his writing, it's good, yeah. Good stuff. All right. Before we leave copyright and the ongoing battle of what rights holders want you to do and what rights holders want intermediaries to do, it's worth mentioning that Facebook has now extended its Rights Manager tool, which it released in 2016. It's basically Facebook's equivalent to YouTube and Google's Content ID tool. Rights Manager has now been extended to video and audio posts on Instagram as well. So how this works is if you are a creator, you basically populate the Rights Manager tool with things that you want the site to look out for, things that you think are going to be subject of infringement. And if those are detected, then rather than you having to send a DMCA takedown notice, Rights Manager will operate in that way for you. It will flag it and take it down. So more and more automation of that process. Are you surprised by this, anybody? Matt?
Yeah, I'm surprised it wasn't a thing before. I believe that YouTube makes a fairly substantial amount of revenue from offering this service to third parties. And I would assume that Facebook does the same for large companies who want to manage their content. So yeah, I'm just more surprised that it wasn't there already and it wasn't part of their business model.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. So once Rights Manager is enabled, all uploaded reference files are protected across both Facebook and Instagram for creators. Yeah. So if
an infringer posts your Instagram work on Facebook, you'll still realize that if you're monitoring Content ID solely in Instagram?
Yeah, it does it for both platforms. Cool. So, and as with Content ID, you know, fair use just doesn't play a role here. If you're someone who has posted something and has had something taken down because it's been flagged by Rights Manager or Content ID, that's when you need to start thinking about, hey, should that really have happened? Because these automated services sort of take all the analysis out of it and really put a lot of control into the hands of the rights holders to determine when and how and whether their stuff is going to be shared at all. So,
Denise, on that issue, yes. Actually, obviously we've heard a lot about the difficulty of challenging Content ID takedowns, but I don't know if I've personally heard much discussion around the similar problem in Rights Manager. Do we know, or do you know, have you heard from the general space whether the same exact issues are happening in Rights Manager as we're seeing in Content ID? Is one of them doing better than the other? I imagine they're probably doing similar to underlying technologies, but I'm interested in
seeing. I don't know that much about it. I don't know anything about their underlying technology. Just know that one is more established than the other. Content ID is, I feel like there would be distinctions because it's designed for a site that only shares video, and Facebook and Instagram do other things too. So I don't know if, you know, that changes the dynamic at all. But so I really don't know. And it, again, it's a far younger tool at this point. So I think we're still watching it evolve, and this is part of its evolution to spread across more Facebook owned platforms. One thing, just anecdotally, we were watching the Olympic skiing last night, and I think my husband was trying to pull up Franz Klammer from 1976 so he could show my son, and was wildly frustrated that he could not find a good clip of that. And I was like, Content ID, DMCA, people are keeping their stuff off the video sharing platforms. He's like, yeah, but it's from 1976. Oh, do you know how long copyright lasts, actually?
Forever.
Yeah, it will it will be off there for a long time. So I just anecdotally, I don't know if he just wasn't searching well or not, but he couldn't find what he wanted.
I'm just very glad that amongst us, we quote 1976 skiers much better than we do football players. So that just makes me happy.
I think that's probably true. All right, let's move on to something a little more lighthearted, shall we? Who doesn't love dog rates? Everybody loves dog rates. Let's talk about how much Ellen loves dog rates next. I don't know that I have any definitive legal answers to this little conundrum, but
I was wanting to ping Mike on this issue too.
Caught my eye this week because every now and then, and again, who doesn't love We Rate Dogs on Twitter? Been around for quite some time, not sure how many years now, but several, and it is sort of the be all and end all of rating dogs. It has a book. It has a store with merchandise. It has a whole lexicon. I go around calling my dog Doggo because of this site, okay? And I'm sure I probably wouldn't have done that or ever really heard that term, or pupper, or tell her that she's puptastic. It literally has changed the way that we speak and think for those of us who are fans of the site or even sort of passing fans of the site. It's had a huge cultural impact, I guess, is what I'm trying to get across. And there are probably people using these terms, and I don't think it claims to have invented all or maybe even any of these terms, but it's certainly put them together around the notion of dogs and how wonderful they are. So the Ellen DeGeneres show tweeted out, and I guess it's been doing this for a while, but it's going to have Ellen rate dogs. Their tweet said, "Do you have a photo of a dog that you need rated? Look no further. Hashtag Ellen rate my dog." And then over at We Rate Dogs, the subsequent tweet was, "LOL, yeah, look no further, because if you do, well, you'll find out we exist." So they're clearly a bit miffed that they're being
Did you notice that We Rate Dogs has also added a TM to their username, to their handle?
Yes, I did notice that. And I'm sure that they have trademarked some stuff and that that is one way to protect what they're doing. But I don't actually know that there is any way they can keep Ellen DeGeneres from deciding she too is going to rate dogs, because the whole notion of rating dogs does not seem to be an IP protectable thing. So there may not be a whole lot of legal recourse there. You know, if she starts using the whole lexicon that they have developed, that may be something to talk about. Most of the We Rate Dogs fans just seem to be saying, hey, Ellen, you know, this is so uncool. Of course you know about this website, and of course you should be giving them credit and maybe even giving copies of their books to your entire audience when you do this segment. And I think that's just a fine idea, because it does seem like they're sort of piggybacking on something that started online and became quite a phenomenon and now has moved to the small screen. Anybody have any other thoughts about this, Matt?
I just want to compare their ratings. I want to see if they're consistent. And like, you know, what about quality control? That's what I'm really worried about here. No, I think it's, you know, she probably stole the idea. There's no IP to protect it. And so, you know, the We Rate Dog fans or whatever their name is, they should definitely not stop watching Ellen. I think it's cool, and I love the language change. I think that's a really interesting tidbit.
In what way? From hashtag rate my dog to hashtag Ellen rate my dog, or hashtag we rate dogs to hashtag Ellen rate my dog?
No, just that the language. I can't remember what Denise said about the words that have come into her lexicon. I think it's really interesting.
The heckin' huge amount of words that we use now because of this site.
Yeah, that's just so cool.
Or some of us do anyway. I don't know.
All doggos are good doggos.
All doggos are good doggos for sure. There was something else that was sort of rattling around in my brain about this. It just sort of flew out again. It's occupational hazard. All right. Emery, any other?
CT in the chat suggests that maybe we just, you know, cut out the middleman and put the We Rate Dogs on the blockchain. I'm not sure what it would solve.
There we go. Yes. Every rated dog on the blockchain.
Blockchain references in this Week in Law episode. Keep accounting.
I think you're barking up the wrong tree.
Oh.
And I remember what I wanted to mention, and that is that Ellen is not the first to decide that rating dogs is something fun to get into, that they want to get into because, you know, having been inspired by this site. If you go on Twitter and you accidentally type in dog rates or we rate dogs, you're not going to get the actual real Twitter account that we're talking about here, because that one is dog_rates. So unless you type in that, you're going to wind up at some site who's decided they're going to do their own version of rating dogs because they have a handle that's close to the one that has made itself famous for this. So
it's a hotbed of entrepreneurship here.
Yes, those accounts are still up and viable and haven't been pulled down, and I don't think violate any of Twitter's terms, although I wonder if discussions have been had about that. All right, let us move on and talk about some...
I don't think you can avoid it.
What?
I don't think you can avoid a discussion of blockchains anymore. Someone's talked to him about it.
We'll be back to the show in just a moment, but right now we're going to thank our sponsor, Grasshopper. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but requires no hardware purchase. With their iOS and Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. When you make a call, your client will see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number. Toll-free numbers are great for marketing and make your business sound more professional. Simply select a toll-free or local number, record a custom greeting, and add multiple extensions for your business. Set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. Get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments. With the Read Your Voicemail feature, a transcription of each voicemail is included with email notifications. You can also send and receive SMS text messages from your business number. Join the over 300,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 a month. You have a 30-day money-back guarantee, 24/7 live U.S. support, and no long-term contracts that you can upgrade at any time. Sound more professional and stay connected to Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. Thank you so much, Grasshopper, for your support. And now we'll look at some stories from the social web. So we're moving from a discussion of what web hosts are responsible, in what ways web hosts are responsible for the legal wrongdoings of their users, to a discussion of ways in which they're going to enforce their own guidelines that they've decided are important to them, regardless of what the law might be. This brings us to two things. First, I just wanted to highlight for folks who remember that not too long ago we had Professor Eric Goldman on the show, and he was gearing up for a conference at his law school, Santa Clara School of Law, that was called Content Moderation and Removal at Scale. A sort of beefy title. We were trying to encourage him to name it something more pithy, it captures what they needed to discuss at this conference, which happened at February 2nd. And Professor Goldman has a whole slew of links, a whole roundup of videos from the conference, and all kinds of information. Because it's about this issue of how, if you're Facebook or YouTube or what have you, you police the activity of the users on your site. And of course, we've been dealing with how you police them when they're perhaps engaging in intellectual property infringement, but how you police them when they're engaging in a whole host of other activities too, some of which may be perfectly legal. And may constitute something that we would put in the First Amendment realm. However, as we like to remind you on this show, if you are not a government entity, then you're not required, except in very limited ways, to be a platform for free speech. So that's why all of these services have to grapple with, you know, what are we going to let people do? What is going to be considered crossing the line and what is not? So YouTube has had to grapple with that in the case of Logan Paul, and it has arrived at some decisions. Logan Paul is the controversial video blogger who has engaged in various kinds of objectionable conduct, including his story about the suicide forest in Japan, and various other bad things. And YouTube has
electrocuted an animal with a taser recently.
Yes, that came up in one of the pieces that we've got in the rundown. Various reasons why YouTube is taking actions against him. They have not suspended his account, but they have announced some policies that are going to apply. Three new potential punishments announced by YouTube's VP of product management. They include removing somebody's YouTube channel from Google's Google Preferred ad tier, or the cancellation of a YouTube Red original series, or suspending ads, and even permanent expulsion from the YouTube Partner Program. So this is how YouTube is dealing with these issues and explaining that, you know, if Logan Paul or others like him continue to engage in violations like this, you know, it will 13 strikes and they will be out at some point.
But that was a good callback.
Yeah. On the way there, they're going to, you know, I'm sure it's a very big deal for these independent content creators to have their revenue streams cut off. And that's what Google's going about here. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, I think it's a really, really interesting topic about how do these private companies set boundaries about what kind of content can be on there. This case is a little bit easier. I mean, he was showing pictures or videos of someone who had committed suicide, and he was like tasering animals, and that just seems like insane and bizarre. And so that's an easier case. You know, the more difficult cases are, you know, when there's some political advocacy being made that's outside of a normal or what used to be normal or anything like that. You know, those are the ones where, you know, that's really where it starts to feel like there should be a First Amendment kicking in, but there's not. But these private companies have to solve this. And I think that, you know, as bad as the tagline for the conference was, but these are really age-old questions that are just at scale now. You know, private you know, your farmer's market had to ask that question, answer that question before, and your grocery store had to answer that question, and you know, all of private businesses have, but these businesses are just so massive in online platforms that they just affect everybody. So I think it's really interesting. One really interesting conversation I had maybe 5 or 6 months ago was with – he was the head of online dispute resolution for eBay for a while. And it's just insane the number of you know, disputes that they handle in an extrajudicial sense, and just like the kind of like complex sociology that goes into setting these up. And I think that YouTube kind of gets to do the same thing. I think it's fascinating, and it's really, really hard to do. And good luck to them. That's because you're always going to make somebody mad.
Yeah.
Yep. Hard not to. Emery, what do you think?
Oh, I was really excited about this conference. I had forgotten that it occurred until this morning. We actually, in the interview with Mike Masick, he was talking about attending this this conference, and I was looking forward to the Cliff Notes on it, his coverage on it. But you know, this issue is content moderation. You know, it really touches on all the things that we've been talking about today and more. Not only is it, you know, objectionable material on YouTube, but it, you know, not only could it be copyright infringement we're talking about, it could be fake news we're talking about, it could be, you know, revenge porn, a whole host of how do you effectively moderate while, it's a very, very tough issue. As Matt elaborated earlier, it does not seem like I guess theoretically it's a solvable problem, but, I don't think that we're anywhere near the point where we can talk about technical solutions to this problem on a large scale.
Right. I don't think, yes, we're talking about Content ID and Rights Manager, and I don't think that kind of thing works in this scenario at all.
No. And I think the issue with Logan Paul is also, you know, it is an issue in the YouTube community at large, because on the one hand, you have creators that are obviously are not in the top 10 list of YouTube creators and, you know, of ad revenue. They are feeling like they're getting hit by these sort of new requirements for their content, or having their content, you know, delisted from advertisements because it's supposedly not advertiser friendly, but they're talking about like LGBT issues or, you know, a whole host of, again, these things that you sort of feel like there might be, or there should have been maybe First Amendment protections. But yeah, it is a very tough issue. And, you know, I don't know. Do we want to even have a, like, at the end of the day, I, you know, it's hard. It is easy to morally fault YouTube for giving a lot of leeway to these shock artists that are essentially, you know, exploiting young eyes, or, you know, exploiting eyeballs by doing outrageous behavior, because they're making, I mean, what is this list that we have in the thing? Like $13 million a year, I think, was much Logan Paul was making last year.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, of course, there's so much money to be made in here. It doesn't feel like, honestly, a 3 strikes or 13 strikes rule would be applied universally anyways.
Right. And I may have spoken too soon. I did not attend the Content Moderation and Removal at Scale conference, and nor have I gone through all the materials that I just mentioned. But I noticed here in the list that there is a video on the topic of the history and future of content moderation, and there's another one called Humans versus Machines. So I'm wondering if they did do some talking and speculating about how you do this in a more automated way and utilizing AI and machine learning, and
Talking to Mike, I definitely understood that as being a primary topic, or at least it was in the context of when we brought it up. It was all about how do we handle the, with technology ideally, or how do we handle the oncoming flood of fake news that is manufactured with technology.
Right. So I'm definitely going to dive into those. And I'm going to take the opportunity too to also plug TechDirt again, Mike Masnick's website, because he's been publishing a lot of the material and writings by people who spoke at that conference. And if you go to TechDirt and click on their content moderation tag, you'll get to all that stuff is among the right at the top right now, the recent stuff on his site. So fascinating stuff. Oh, one more thing on the social web before we leave it. And that is a reminder. This, I think, is really fascinating, actually. And of course, I seize on the opportunity to discuss the Kardashians whenever possible in a legal context. And here they've done something kind of fascinating. As you know, if you've been watching the show for some time, the FTC frowns on people passing off things as ads or not as ads on things like Instagram, things that are actually ads. So, you know, you're getting paid for something, you're getting some sort of tit for tat, and you're posting photos of yourself attending the Fire Festival or on your way to attend the Fire Festival, and you're not disclosing that you were paid for this or otherwise promised beautiful accommodations at the Fire Festival or what have you. Something really interesting here has happened on Instagram involving Kim Kardashian, Kanye West, the Yeezy clothing line that he designs, and a bunch of their friends. And the Fashion Law blog pointed out that what's been going on here is probably a violation of the FTC's clear rules for influencers and brands that they have to disclose when they have received, the language is a material connection between the brand and the individual who's posting. Now, what they did is a bunch of Kanye and Kim's friends duplicated a bunch of photos, paparazzi photos, maybe other more posed photos that are iconic Kim Kardashian photos. But instead, they've put people like Paris Hilton, for example, in the same similar looking clothing and a similar looking pose where you would go, oh, that looks like that photo of Kim. But no, instead, it is Paris Hilton or what have you. There's a whole bunch of models and influencers and the like who have been involved in this. And so these photos are being posted and they are all designed to promote Kanye's fashion line, but there's absolutely no mention of anything like that except for the hashtag Yeezy season 6. There's no hashtag ad, there's no hashtag spawn. It's just, you know, bringing attention to the brand. Quite a creative way to do an ad campaign, but I'm not convinced it's not afoul of the FTC rules. What do you guys think, Emery?
I would love to. I mean, I am sitting here with rapt attention because I don't really understand the distinction. I mean, I understand obviously the you don't want deceptive advertisement practices, but on the other hand, I sort of assume, I guess. Well, I'm sorry. I think I maybe misunderstood this. These are being posted not from Kanye's Instagram handle, but from various Instagram influencers.
The various people themselves. Like,
do they make a practice of frequently, like, aren't they walking advertisements? Like, isn't like an Instagram influencer just like a viral ad with legs? Like, I don't understand.
Maybe, but the FTC doesn't think so. The FTC thinks that when people interact with them and their Instagram accounts, they think that they are interacting with an individual. And if that individual says, hey, I really like this mascara, and they haven't said that they are being paid to say that people will assume that they're not being paid and that, hey, they actually like that mascara, I should try it. So I think that that is the conundrum here. That there's a connection. They were, you know, we don't know what the financial arrangements were between these people and the Yeezy brand, but it's a good assumption that there were financial arrangements.
So does every viral ad have to have a disclaimer that it's an ad? I feel like so many, I mean, I haven't following the space very much, but I feel like it's common practice to sort of see some weird 30-second obscure video or whatever and have no idea what it means. And then 2 weeks later, it turns out, oh, that was some sort of marketing thing for something that no one knows about. How do viral advertisements work in the FTC? You know,
I think there's a lot of tension there. I think the FTC has guidelines, and if there's a material connection where you've been paid and you're not disclosing it, you're subject to getting stern letters and fines.
I see.
And they've not been shy about fining people. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, but it seems like the most times, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know too tremendous about this bit. Not about the space, but the times that I've seen fines actually been imposed, they've been when there was some other thing going on. So the Firefest was like, you know, that was just seemed like massive frauds. And so a lot of people got fines from that. But, you know, there's, to Amory's point, there's so many times where this goes on. And unless there's another connection with some illegal activity or some fraudulent activity, it doesn't seem like it's being imposed. And you are asking, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here too, you're asking an AUSA to go after somebody for posting something on Instagram in which they got paid for. That just seems like really, really low level stuff that, like, I don't want the attorney going after that kind of stuff. I hope they have better things to do. So I kind of think it's a silly rule. I agree with Emery. Like these people who have 130,000 followers or X million of followers, like, I think you can just assume that they're getting paid to do something. And you know, the question is, so if you have your own private company, if you are a fashion person and you have your own line of company, you know, do you have to put that on there? We know that you're doing this for the company. But there's a, you know, there's a distinction between the person and the corporation, and you're doing it for the corporation. So, but I've never seen
it's
one
like
for
the
that.
Barriers between your identity and your brand is so intangible now. And like, if you are your brand, then everything that you do is an advertisement for something, right?
Yeah. I mean, and you can apply this to the political space. You know, I just don't
see advertising for somebody else. Right.
Yeah.
FTC doesn't want people to get confused about what's sincere and what's paid.
But they don't make you do this when you're on television. You know, you go on there and you wear a hat for some company and you're clearly getting paid for it. They just expect you to understand that, you know, these people who go up and do these commercials, like, it's an advertisement. So it's like a cultural understanding of that. And that's why I think it's valuable, Emery's point of, like, if we kind of know that these people are, you know, walking advertisements and they're, you know, publicizing a different thing every 2 days – it's kind of obvious. I'm not sure how much we're protecting the public through this.
Yeah, I get your point. I don't think the FTC does, or, you know, if they're fighting the losing battle and misutilizing the resources that you guys characterize them of doing, I don't think they've acknowledged it yet.
You know, it's just
someday. Emery and I are taking that hill.
Right.
With the FTC taking claim over net neutrality issues, you know, they've got so much to enforce. Let's, you know, pick your battles a little better, guys. Come on. There's bigger fish to fry.
It's a good point. All right. What do we have next? Oh, as long as we're in the realm of the light and fluffy, and as long as we're in the midst of the Olympics, I put this under trademark. I'm not sure that's really the right place for it, but let's play the bumper anyway. Even though we're a technology law show, we do from time to time bring you stories from the world of fashion that don't have to do with things like Instagram, because the world of fashion is actually pretty interesting to look at from an IP standpoint, because unlike the world of music and film and imagery, where copyrights are very strong and very aggressively pursued and enforced, fashion is this loosey-goosey world where it's very hard to demonstrate that someone knocked you off. And even if they did, it's kind of a so what affair. I mean, it's very hard to enforce copyrights in fashion goods. That's why we talked a lot about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in that cheerleading uniform case that you may recall. So it's interesting to compare those two realms. And certainly every now and then a fashion infringement question pops up that we think is interesting. And this is one of them, probably because I like to ski and I was familiar with the brand in question here. But if you watched the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, you might have noticed that the U.S. team was appareled all by Ralph Lauren, head to toe, including their mittens. And in fact, it looks like Ralph Lauren, ooh, this could be actually a key point of distinction. Ralph Lauren made gloves, not mittens, were made of leather and have fringe hanging off, and lots of people fell in love with them as soon as they caught sight of them. And they were selling them on the Team USA site for something like $950 a pair. You could own a pair of these Ralph Lauren gloves that they designed for the opening ceremonies, but they are long since sold out.
A really good skier?
No, but you can use them skiing. See, most often you would never.
Do they make me 21 again?
Maybe.
Do they call actually, it? Yeah.
Who knows if you can use the Ralph Lauren one skiing? But there is a brand in the ski industry called Astes. They make mittens. I don't know if they also make gloves. People started immediately. Oh, I guess they do make gloves too. They started immediately saying, those Ralph Lauren gloves sure look a lot like the Astes. And sure enough, they do. I mean, they're just very, very, very similar, both in materials and design. And I do know, because I've tried them on before, and I've tried them on in ski shops, the Astes ones you can ski in. They have skiers who ski in their gloves. And hopefully, if they post pictures of themselves in the gloves, put hashtag spawn if they were given those gloves on their Instagram posts. In any event, the Astes company apparently too, just to sort of add insult to injury, and this sort of calls back to our rating dogs discussion as well. Astes was contacted by Ralph Lauren in the years leading up to the current opening ceremonies, and apparently there was some discussion of whether they were going to partner up, and ultimately they did not partner up, and Ralph Lauren just did what it did. So Astes is sad. They has a sad, but they're not going to sue. They're happy that they have been given a bit more exposure. They're just presumably they're hoping that they won't be presumed to have riffed off the Ralph Lauren opening ceremonies gloves, because they've been there a long time and have been doing these beautiful designs. And they also just to throw another little aspect of problematic component into this. The Astes line is the first to give credit to the fact that all of their gloves and mittens in this, they're inspired by vintage ranch gloves and rugged Western style, and specifically by a pair that were handmade in trade for a pocket knife, if I remember the story correctly, by a Cree woman. So there's the whole cultural appropriation aspect we could go into as well. Astes very much attributes part of its inspiration to Native American design and has actually, in the course of getting more publicity for their company around the Olympics here, is partnering up with a line that is made by and promoting the designs of and very much in the world of Native American culture to work together to promote those designs and ideas and credit them properly. Ralph Lauren may have ripped off Astey's gloves, may have by extension ripped off Native American design, and yet they are all sold out of their $950 pairs. Any thoughts, guys?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So my first thought is the idea that Ralph Lauren even ripped off this company's mittens, I feel like is it's like a foregone conclusion in all of the articles writing about this issue. But as far as I can see, I mean, granted, fashion law is a fascinating but complex area of the law that I don't think makes a lot of sense frequently. But as I'm looking at it, I mean, our listeners can't see what we're looking at, and I actually can't see what's on screen right now. But comparing the two gloves, we're talking about a glove that Ralph Lauren has for the Olympics team, which is, you know, fingered glove. It looks like your standard leather workers welder's glove, frankly, with some tassels on the side. And then the Astis glove mitten that's being discussed is a mitten, so it's not gloved. It has this elaborate sort of artwork element around the wrist that is a completely different cloth and texture and color and design. And it has totally different kinds of tassels, and it has a totally different kind of cuff. It looks like there's like this a furry cuff around the wrist. So it just seems like it's a completely different mitten altogether. And then he didn't even design it. He ripped this off from another party. And so, I mean, yeah, it's like, oh, Astis sure is being generous by not suing Ralph Lauren. On what grounds would he sue them? I don't understand how this is infringing.
Yes. So presumably they've either conferred with counsel and gotten to that point, or just decided, yeah, no, not gonna go there. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Emery on that, but you know, it's also like pretty crappy business practices, which is not a legal suit that you can bring. Although sometimes I wish it was that Ralph
maybe,
Lauren.
Maybe it's not though. I mean, Ralph Lauren says they were always going to pick a wild, you know, a Westerner like design for the gloves. And if that is the case, I'm not saying we don't know that for sure. But if it is the case that they were always going to choose a Western design, I don't think that the Western design that they picked for their gloves is any way similar to the Western design of the Astis mittens.
No. So the process, though, is the calls and the interviews, and they asked them to send them the gloves and all of that. So they were getting mm-hmm. this company to do all their market research for them, and then they went out and used it. So that's mm-hmm. you know, that's not illegal. That's, you know, I guess when I think about it, I've done things where I've gotten competitors to do market research for me by asking them for pricing and all of that. So, you know, that's, you know, a hypocrite with that, but you know, that's, right. that's what emotionally feels bad about the story from his perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sad. Cause I mean, you may be hopeful that you're going to partner up with a big company like Ralph Lauren. That could have been a nice, feather in their cap, if I can use that expression in this context.
good one.
Thank
That's
you.
Yes, yeah, nicely done.
You also, you know, so you want to take that call, but you also don't have to take that call, and you might have to be thinking to yourself when you do take that call, hey, maybe they're just trying to use our company, and that seems to have been the route here. Let's see. If we're all done with gloves, let's talk about AIs that will read privacy policies for you, shall we, as we round out the show here?
Yes.
All right, Emery, tell us what's going on here.
All right. So I know that we've talked about this on the show in years past, but the idea that, or rather the reality that we all live in, is that privacy policies are not written to be read by humans. And as a result, they are not read by humans. I think the article here cites something like 0.7% of people, don't quote me on that, but 0.7% of people, according to this article, 0.07% of people actually click on terms of service links before clicking I agree. So it's a huge problem. I think it's, frankly, if you want to like sit me down with a beer and we can talk about the problems with the world, I think that it's one of the biggest elephant in the room issues in the entire field of contract law. The idea that basically all of our online contracting world is built in, you know, is built on a foundation that is a legal fiction, that is, people can consent to these agreements that they're agreeing to, because consent requires knowledge of the terms. And what we had talked about before is the idea that there are researchers or technologists that have proposed that we might be able to leverage technology to do something about this problem. And the ideal for a long time has been, what if we could create an AI that would maybe act as like an extension on your browser that could, you know, you could press a button and it would do the language processing and read a privacy policy for you and extract the relevant information and then translate it into something that is common parlance. And surprise, it is already here and it exists. It's a thing and it's great. It's very cool. So the University of Wisconsin and the University of Michigan announced the release of Polysis, together with Switzerland's researchers at Switzerland's Federal Institute of Technology at Lausanne. Lausanne. Oh, I'm sorry, Swiss listeners. But essentially, it has the ability to type in a URL, and it will search for it for the privacy policy of that website. And then it will do exactly what we described. It'll break it down and tell you, you know, what information they're sharing, what choices you have. There actually is a chatbot that you can engage with where you can ask questions in more or less natural language English and have it respond. It will proffer questions for you if you don't know what to ask. So you can, you know, once it loads up, and I think I'm having internet issues, so I cannot see what's on screen right now. But if you were to load up, LinkedIn.com, you'd be able to see a visualization of the privacy policy itself, types of info they collect, for what reason, what choices you have. You can then ask a question and it will ask you, it will proffer questions where, like, can I opt out of anything? Or what types of personal information do you collect? How long is the data retained? Do you honor do not track requests? I love this tool so much. I love it so, so much, because it is a way of giving users a previously impossible, really, abilities to interact with the websites that they're agreeing to every day. And it allows people to actually look at privacy policies and learn something and understand what's happening. And I mean, privacy is an issue that is incredibly nebulous frequently, and it's often very difficult to connect privacy interests with sort of concrete concerns or like concrete damages. And a huge reason of that, I think, is because all of the parlance of what actually is being done legally is essentially obscured through these legal documents that are not made to be read by humans and are not read by humans and cannot be read by humans. We do not have the time or the ability to do that wholesale. And so I love this tool. I think it's just fascinating. And I didn't expect this. I didn't think it would be this good this soon at all. I thought that we had another like 5 years before we'd see something like this, but it's very capable. And I highly encourage everyone to check it out. You can find it at prybot.org. It's not going to have every terms of service. I tried looking up Tinder's, and for some reason they had trouble with Tinder, but they've got a number of them, and it's just so cool. It's so cool.
Yeah, I can't wait to play with it. I hope that everyone watching and listening will do that too. Prybot.org is a great URL too, easy to remember. So yeah, definitely. I wish that there were a way to incorporate it so that it was actually part of people's thinking process when they're agreeing to these things, or when these terms actually make a difference to them. Instead, it seems like it's going to be something where if you have a little free time on your hand, you're bored and curious yeah. or something has reminded you, then you might pull it up and start chatting with the chatbot and educate yourself a little bit. And that's not a bad thing.
No, and granted, I haven't yeah. actually gotten to I that's a lie. It's not that I haven't gotten to. I have not. I have failed in this area for you listeners. I had not pulled out the actual Chrome extension or Firefox extension and seen how that works. I know that historically, mm-hmm. another goal of these types of AI privacy assistance has been to learn a user's preferences. And then it could do exactly that. You know, you could mm-hmm. let your privacy bot know that, for example, I am really against agreeing to terms where I don't have any opt-out abilities or where I'm automatically opted in. And then, mm-hmm. you know, PryBot, the extension, I don't know if it does it now, but I think that it might do it in the future, and certainly they're considering it, is, you know, as you go to a website, it might flag you and say, hey, by the way, this, these terms probably run counter to your interests. Because everyone's not going to have the same privacy interests. But I totally agree, Denise, that some more active way of working with this technology while you are agreeing to the agreements in real time would be very useful. And I hope that it comes along.
Great. I think that'll be our second MCLE passphrase for the show: bots that save us. We're so often worried about the bots eradicating us, but these might actually help us out. So I definitely can't wait to check that one out. That's our second MCLE passphrase. I don't think I've mentioned this episode that if you are interested in more information about applying for continuing legal education credit in your jurisdiction and you are a lawyer in the United States, head on over to wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there, and there are some resources there that should be able to help you out. Matt, any thing you want to add about bots reading privacy policies for you?
Yeah, so after you get done having a beer with Emery about privacy terms, you can come and get one with me about the unauthorized practice of law, because as cool as this is illegal in every jurisdiction. Which is crazy and insane, but that's the case. It's giving legal advice, a non-lawyer giving legal advice. It's clearly the unauthorized practice of law, and so that's the state of our legal cartel. And you know, lawyers are benefiting from not being able to get information about your own rights. So
that's a really interesting point. Yeah. Hadn't really thought that part, but then again, you know, yeah, definitely you're seeing, just like the FTC comes after influencers, the various bars will come after you if you are engaged, and more than just the various bars, the various attorneys general will come after you if you are engaged in an unauthorized practice of law. And what constitutes that is a moving target these days. So good point.
It's crazy broad, and it basically is like whatever business lawyers are typically in, they get to protect that. So, LegalZoom has been fighting this forever. Mm-hmm. They're really good at litigating it, but unless Wisconsin and Michigan are willing to, you know, pay the fees to get this done, if someone comes after them, they're just going to close this shop. So.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, this is based in only part of it's based in the U.S., right? We've got researchers at Switzerland's Federal Institute of Technology at Lausanne and the University of Wisconsin and the University of Michigan are involved in this. So, you know, I don't see the Swiss being real concerned, but we'll see.
Yeah.
It's a great issue. Thanks for that, Matt. We need to have to dive on, you know, we should have a guest on to talk about that issue in particular and dive into it for an hour and a half. I'd be fascinated.
Yeah, we should. We absolutely should. All right. Speaking of what bots will and will not do, let's do our tips of the week. Our first tip of the week is that bots will feed you tomatoes. This has absolutely nothing to do with the law, except if you are being fed tomatoes by a bot. This is a Japanese robot called Tomaton that will feed you tomatoes while you run. I don't know why you would want tomatoes while you run, but it is a promotion for a Japanese vegetable juice maker called called Kagome. And yeah, the little guy sits on your shoulders while you run and has a tomato head and is apparently, aside from being adorable, potentially a legal hazard. I guess that's technology putting everyone at risk. Well, you really your vision and mouth are being obscured while you're on a run.
The legal question still stems back to, is the tomato a fruit or a vegetable? Which is like the endless legal question.
That's right. Listener Jonathan Annett, who always sends in good stuff, sent this in and said, I don't know how you're going to talk on the show about this because I really don't see the tie-in. But of course, you know, you have it just like with self-driving cars, self-feeding robots may be an issue that needs to be regulated.
Oh. We didn't get into it today, but the article or the law school journal article about, or I don't actually know where the source was, but the article comparing, saying that the best analogy for autonomous vehicles is to compare it to horseback or to horses. I thought yes. It was absolutely fascinating. I hope you guys talk about it next week.
It is. I stuck it into next week because I knew we had a lot going on this week, including the fact if we're going to talk about what neural nets can and cannot do. We just celebrated Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day, boys. Emery, I thought you in particular would love the candy heart messages authored by a neural network.
I missed an opportunity there for a blog post for sure.
Yes, you did. Just so you know, neural networks are now authoring candy hearts. I wonder if the candy heart manufacturer who for decades and eons has made candy hearts has an issue with neural nets horning in on their territory and turf here. Any particular ones that you loved, Emery?
Oh, Take a Love is really good. You Are Babe is also great. I like
what
the ones at the bottom.
Good mean?
Yeah, who knows? I love it though. I like the ones at the bottom that make less sense. Like, hold on, scroll up a little bit. I just missed one. All Hover.
All Hover.
All Hover.
I wonder, it's sort of existential. That's sort of fun. All right. What else do we have? We have resources aplenty. We have Tech Policy Grind, the podcast that Emery and others at the Internet Law and Policy Foundry are involved in. We know you interviewed Mike Masnick. Another really interesting looking recent show was discussing the technological vulnerability of the Olympics. What else you been up to there?
Yeah, so Tech Policy Grind is a project that I'm actually really proud of. It's turning into something very cool, and I'm really happy with it. So if you think of This Week in Law as being sort of a discussion of the recent events at the intersection of law and technology, we focus a lot on This Week in Law, on the actual issues themselves. What I wanted to do was with Tech Policy Grind was, first off, highlight the awesome people, other fellows at the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. The Internet Law and Policy Foundry is a collection of early career professionals in the tech law space. They're all really driven. A lot of them are doing fascinating work. And what I wanted to do with Tech Policy Grind is to shine a light on the fact that that career is even an option. Because I know that when I was in undergrad, when I was in high school, I was interested in law. I was interested in technology, but I didn't really understand that this was a career that you could pursue. And if I did understand that it was a career that you could pursue, I had no idea how to get from interest to work. And so on this show, what we do is that we pull in another member of the Internet Law and Policy Foundry or Friends of the Foundry or for the State of the Net conference interviews that we did. We just spoke with panelists at the conference. But we tried to talk about, we split the show up into really two distinct parts. We tried to talk about during the first part sort of their background, their journey, offering just a view of the individual and then how they got to what they're doing and any lessons they have along the way to share with everyone else. And then we dive down into one or two really interesting areas of their work. And it's less a canvas of the weekly discussion topics. It's more about let's talk about this career option and then let's talk about one fascinating area they do in their career. And so I've had a lot of fun with it. I'm excited about what we've got coming up. I think we've got, we release twice a month on Mondays. We just released an episode last week with Angel Diaz. And the upcoming episodes, I believe, we're going to have two back-to-back blockchain episodes. Later in May, we're going to have a month of GDPR coverage. And you can find us at iTunes, Stitcher, maybe not Stitcher. Still got to work on that. But Google Play, iTunes, anywhere else where podcasts are found. There's something wrong with our podcast feed. If you know information about making Stitcher work with our podcast feed, maybe reach out to me and help. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. And if you like what you hear, I really would love to, I would be remiss to not make a plug right now to one of our, all of our wonderful listeners that if you're listening to Tech Policy Grind and you have an iPhone or an iTunes account, it would be a huge help to go to iTunes and leave a review, or maybe just rate it or just share it on Twitter. It's very, very, I like to say it's indie. In a way that maybe belies the fact that I don't think many people are listening to it. But I have a great time, and I hope you will enjoy it as well.
Yes, I'm so excited that you're doing it. Congratulations. I know it's hard work, and I encourage you to stick with it. I'm so fortunate in that the hard work, like making sure our podcast feed work, is not my responsibility.
I've got to say that making a podcast has been the biggest learning experience has been on the sound production side. It's a lot of fun, frankly, to bring some people on Skype and talk about interesting stuff. I love that. I could do that all day. What I had no idea about was Victor, I know a lot of work goes into that. I had no idea how much work goes into making sure that everyone's microphones are working, making sure that there's no production guffaws in the middle of the show, making sure that you don't lose an episode's worth of recorded audio because someone's hard drive filled up in the middle of recording. All of those things have happened. A huge round of applause for the Twit Studio folks that make this wonderful machine operate.
Applause. For the Twit Studio and Twit in general.
Yes.
It is the awesome. We hope that whatever you think of Twit, we are still running the Twit survey. We'd love to have you let us know exactly what you think in a fine-grained way of the network and its various shows. Head on over to twit.tv/survey. Make your voice heard. We really appreciate it if you can do that to let us know what kind of job we're doing. It's very helpful for us. And also, if you are Echo owners, Amazon Echo owners, I know this is what I do every single morning when I'm making coffee and making breakfast is the flash briefing feature of the Echo. I just absolutely love it. I love that you can customize it. You can make it go on for a really long time if you keep adding things to it. So I find that when I'm down in the kitchen, doing all that stuff. Sometimes it's just keeping me company for, I don't know, like an hour and a half. And one of the things that you can put in there is our Twit Flash Briefing. It's available in Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom, and India, and of course here in the United States, where it's been available for a while. So if you haven't done it yet, now's the perfect time to go into your Alexa app settings and under Flash Briefing, look for Twit. Hopefully you'll put us right at the top of your Flash Briefing, but I'm happy if you put us in there anywhere at all. We're going to conclude today's show with a fun entry into our weekly animal selfie of the week. So this week's animal selfie of the week is a whole show. It is from the BBC. It is called Animals with Cameras. It is a wildlife documentary series where scientists put cameras on animals, filming unique footage of meerkats, chimps, wild penguins, all kinds of other things. There was a whole lawsuit about macaque that took a camera and took selfies of itself. Imagine the field day that PETA could and might have with the BBC as it puts selfie cameras on all manner of animals. The hilarious thing for me too about this, it's airing on some of our local PBS stations, I have noticed, on TV. But if you try and pull it up online and you're not using a VPN that says you're in the UK, you'll get a message that says, BBC iPlayer only works in the UK. Sorry, it's due to rights issues. So you can't actually play these online in the UK.
I really like your British accent. It's pretty good.
Thank you so much. And then, Victor, if you could show the third link in that batch, this is just one little clip from their show that has the wonderful caption, when your parent tries to take a selfie and just can't do it, doesn't know what's going on. Of course, it's a monkey just sort of gazing way too close into a camera. But if you love our animal selfie segment, whether you love it for the legal ramifications of animals doing photography or not, you might like this BBC show, and hopefully you can convince them that you're in the UK. With that, we'll go ahead and finish up this episode of This Week in Law. Gentlemen, so great to chat with you today. Emery Roan, great to reconnect with you. We're wishing you all the best, always. Of course.
Yeah, it's honestly, I love this. I love the show. I've been listening to the show since before law school. It's a lot of fun. I really love coming on the show whenever I can. And I hope to be back in the future. So thanks for having me, guys.
Yes, we hope to see you soon. In the meantime, try not to let the tech policy grind you too badly as you're frantically editing and debugging RSS to get your feed to work.
It's getting better every day.
Yes, hopefully. Matt Curtis, great to see you as well.
Great to be on and great to have Emery on. And I will be, I'll give you a little teaser here. I will be sending in my own animal selfie of the week here pretty soon. It involves cows and drones. And I'll leave that as a cliffhanger.
Oh, I can't wait. Won't unfortunately be able to get to it next week because next week we will not be doing a show. But we'll be back the week after that. And we cannot wait to see you then. When you join us then, you might want to join us live. We record the show at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. If you head on over to twit.tv and click watch live now, then you'll be joining us live and warts and all as we do the show. Otherwise, head on over to twit.tv/twill. And that show and this show and all the shows going back to 2006 when we first started this show are there in the archives for you to enjoy. So do check those out when you have time. And if you manage to miss joining us live, join us on whatever device you please. There are some instructions over there for how you can enjoy this on your phone or your TV or via iTunes or via YouTube or whatever your poison is for consuming video entertainment of this kind, or the audio version is available too if that's what you prefer. So we hope that you'll just join us however you'd like to do that, and we hope that you'll get in touch with us between the shows. I am D Howell on Twitter. Matt is Lawpint there. Emery is Emery Roan there. That's a great place to let us know, you know, as you notice things in your Twitter feed that you think we should see, just, you know, shoot them our way. We'd love to see them too, and hopefully can put them into the show one way or another. You can find us on Facebook too. We're This Week in Law there, and that's a great place to, again, as you're surfing around, let us know what caught your eye and let us know that you think it might be a good topic for the show or you have questions or what have you. We love hearing from you between the shows. We love hearing from you in email too. Matt is mattc@twit.tv. I am denise@twit.tv. Once again, you know, sometimes you scratch in your head or up in arms or what have you. Let us know and maybe we can talk about it here. And we very much appreciate you being our eyes and ears out there in the world. So we won't see you next week, but we'll see you shortly thereafter on This Week in Law. Thank you so much for joining us. Great to have both of you guys with me. Let's say goodbye with all three of us if we can.
On Stitcher. Yay! Franklin Gates in the chat, thank you so much for pointing out that Tech Policy Grind does in fact work on Stitcher, and we hope that you subscribe to us on Stitcher or wherever podcasts are found. Thank you.
Yay! Right on. Thanks, everyone. Until next time, take care.